We're the ones getting killed. We're the ones getting shot.
Despite the overwhelming plea for change, there has been no action.
The consensus is to not play in tonight's slate of games.
So our focus today cannot be on basketball.
And to kneel, lock arms, and raise fists during the national anthem.
When we take the court and represent Milwaukee and Wisconsin, we are expected to play at a high level.
We aren't just basketball players. When most of us go home, we still are Black.
We hold ourselves to that standard, and in this moment, we are demanding the same from lawmakers and law enforcement.
You don't need to be Black to be outraged. You need to be American and outraged.
LA Clippers coach Doc Rivers and players from the NBA and WNBA. More than a dozen games were postponed last night across professional sports. Basketball, baseball, soccer, tennis, athletes all refused to play. After days of protests in Wisconsin and nationwide, after a Kenosha police officer shot Jacob Blake 7 times in the back. The strike left leagues scrambling to reschedule games, many of which are playoff games, during a difficult season. It looks like NBA players decided today to resume games as early as tomorrow. And we're going to talk about all this now with Sopan Deb. He's a basketball and culture writer for the New York Times. Welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to talk to you again.
Great to have you back. And we're also joined by Erica Ayala. She's a writer covering women's sports, and she's the host of the podcast Sports Talk with Erica Ayala. Welcome to Press Play.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Great to have you. So, Pam, let's begin with you. You are in the bubble, as it's called, at Disney World in Florida. And this all began with the Milwaukee Bucks. Take us through the decision last night.
Well, I'm going to correct you. I'm actually not in the bubble. My colleague Mark Stein is in the bubble, but I am not there. But basically, look, what happened was the Milwaukee Bucks essentially just took it on themselves to force the issue and not play. After the game, the team read a statement calling for very specific action, including, you know, having the Wisconsin State Legislature to reconvene and to take up, you know, what they called meaningful measures to address issues of police accountability and brutality. And that move, I think, took, you know, not just the league by surprise, other teams by surprise. And as soon as the Bucks did what they did, there was this cascade effect, right? The other NBA games were canceled. Other Major League Baseball games were canceled. I will say, just, you know, I've been watching basketball for much of my life. It was extraordinary. I've never seen anything like that in my life. And who knows what the effects of it will be at this point, but it was quite a remarkable moment.
Yeah, absolutely. And then Erica, also remarkable with the WNBA, when you saw all the players, they are also in a bubble, and the teams gathered in a candlelight vigil. Talk about that.
Yes, the WNBA players also decided not to play. They boycotted yesterday's games, and it was announced that they will not play today. But the WNBA, before Colin Kaepernick and before a lot of what we see happening in sports this year, they've always been a united front, and that's what's been the power in the WNBA for the last 4 or 5 seasons, them using their platform to talk about social justice. And we saw that again last night as all 144-plus players, coaches, even the commissioner, were outside talking about how they were feeling in this moment, not just the fact that they boycotted the games, but how they were feeling and what they were going to do next.
All right. Well, let's hear from one of the players. Her name is Ariel Atkins, and she plays for the Mystics. She spoke to ESPN last night, and she spoke as a young child stood next to her.
We got this little guy right here that we see every day. His life matters. He needs to know that he can do what he wants to do whenever he leaves his house, when he grows up. He matters. And that's what people need to understand. Like, we're not just basketball players. And if you think we are, then don't watch us. You're watching the wrong sport, because we're so much more than that. We're going to say what we need to say, and people need to hear that.
So interesting. And so what's at stake for the WNBA players, Erica, that's perhaps different from the NBA players?
You know, that's an interesting question, and that was Tiana Hawkins' son that Ariel Atkins was talking about. But one thing that is noticeably different about the bubbles is that there are, you know, WNBA players are taking care of their children and their teammates' children. But I think what's at stake here for the WNBA players is that, in a lot of ways, even before entering the wobble, as it's affectionately known, WNBA players felt that the best way to get their message across for social justice was to actually enter into a single site and to have everyone on that united front that I talked about earlier. And I get the impression that that's not the same conversation that NBA players have in mass. A lot of them wonder, from my perspective at least, if it makes sense to have NBA players playing games at all. And I think the conversation is a little bit different for WNBA players, who feel that this is an opportunity. They have a number of their games on national television, which unfortunately does not happen in a season that's played under what we would consider now, you know, pre-coronavirus normal circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Right. So will they resume as the NBA has decided to do?
Yes. They made an announcement, speaking of national television, on national television just about an hour ago, saying that they did have conversations and they will be resuming play. They will not play their slate of three games tonight, but they will resume play and they will update us when that's happening, likely over the weekend. But they also made it clear through their union leader, Nneka Ogumike, who plays for the Los Angeles Sparks, they made it clear that the expectation is that what they were promised when they entered into their wobble will be fulfilled. And I got the sense from Nneka's comments that she really wants the league and perhaps others that are there to support the players and their platform to really make sure that they're elevating their social justice initiatives at all times.
And so, Ben, what was behind the decision to resume today? There hasn't been a lot of public comment on it on the part of the NBA as to, and we don't know exactly when they're going to be resuming play, but were you able to figure out why they decided to call off the strike?
We don't know yet. And there's another meeting that's about to happen between that are including multiple reps from each team and league and the league front office. We don't know yet. Right. We know that, you know, a couple top players in the NBA, particularly on the Lakers and the Clippers last night, you know, they expressed an interest in having not taking part. But we don't know what caused the change of heart. And at this point, and I'm certainly interested to hear, I'm sure some of them will start talking publicly very shortly, especially if the games resume tomorrow. But at this point, we don't know. But for what it's worth, you know, their point has been made in some ways, right? In that mm-hmm. they did what they did. You know, it caused this cascade effect. And look at what we're talking about today. We're talking about...
Yeah, we're leading the show with it.
You know? So we don't know what caused the change of heart for some of the players. We also don't know how many players were that interested in ending the whole season, because another calculation here is that, look, while the games are on TV, we can continue to talk about this in press conference settings and interviews and, you know, on our jerseys or whatever. So there's also that calculation as well.
Do they lose money if they don't play?
It's a complicated question. But we don't know at this point. That's one of those things that you cross that bridge when you get there. Look, there mm-hmm. if the games resume tomorrow with no issue, then they get paid very likely. Also, this is the postseason, not the regular season, so they already got paid for the regular season. The playoff pay comes out of what's called a playoff pool, and it's unclear how that would be affected. Certainly the league would lose money if the games aren't on TV and there's, you know, the TV deals and whatnot. And certainly that would affect the league next year if the season got canceled, because the salary cap is tied to league revenue. But it doesn't seem like it's going to get to that point. It doesn't seem like that's a bridge the NBA is going to have to cross.
I want to talk a bit about the political moment and how this is perhaps affecting that. And here's a clip of tape from White House advisor and the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, speaking on CNBC this morning when he was asked about this strike. Here's what he said.
The NBA players are very fortunate that they have the financial position where they're able to take a night off from work without having to have the consequences to themselves financially. So they have that luxury, which is great. Look, I think with the NBA, there's a lot of activism, and I think that they've put a lot of slogans out. But I think that what we need to do is turn that from slogans and signals to actual action that's going to solve the problem.
All right. And then Trump also weighed in today saying, I think people are tired of the NBA, frankly. He called it a political organization that has very bad ratings. He is obsessed with ratings, after all. So, Sopan, weigh in on that, if you will, like how this has reached the White House, obviously. This is a national conversation. How is this playing against the backdrop of the RNC and its law and order message?
Well, you have to remember that the NBA and Donald Trump, and when I say the NBA, I mean the players from the NBA, they have been publicly sparring going back to 2017. You might remember that one of Donald Trump's early feuds was with Steph Curry when he uninvited the Golden State Warriors from the championship. And then LeBron James went on Twitter and called him a bum. And this has started, you know, a war of words that has lasted many, you know, the entire presidency at this point. So it's not surprising that, you know, Donald Trump would not take kindly to these protests coming from the NBA, in part because so many of the top players in the NBA support his opponent, Joe Biden. LeBron James and Steph Curry support Joe Biden. Steph Curry appeared at the DNC. So it's not entirely shocking that Donald Trump would, you know, he would say that I don't really know much about the protests. All I'm going to say is that the ratings are low, because so much of his self-worth has been defined by ratings, A, and B, the NBA players have been going at him for his entire presidency at this point.
Erica, what do you make of that?
Wow. I mean, it's almost comical, quite honestly, at this point, the conversations that go back and forth between the president and a number of people. But I think that the comments are also they're very misguided. I can't speak to the pay structure for NBA players and even to the WNBA, as now we're not seeing the word strike or boycott used. We're seeing a period of reflection. So maybe that's something that they worked out with the league. But to think that athletes are making enough money that somehow they miraculously can forget that their black bodies at any point in time can be subject to abuse by law enforcement is just utterly ridiculous.
And I was just going to say, and I would also note that the WNBA, this became a national story in terms of touching Republican politics, you know, before this week. If you remember the Atlanta Dream has been in a very public feud with Senator Kelly Loeffler, who is running for the open Senate, running to be reelected to her seat in Georgia. I mean, you had an entire WNBA team coming out and endorsing Kelly Loeffler's opponent, and Kelly Loeffler owned the Atlanta Dream. So, you know, if anything, the WNBA has been in front of this before the NBA was.
Yeah, I was just going to ask Erica about that. That seems like pretty open rebellion to basically come out publicly against your owner, Senator Loeffler.
She's a part owner of the Atlanta Dream, and the conversation, as we saw it play out with the endorsement of her opponent, came because before the return to play in the WNBA, Loeffler herself made comments that it wasn't appropriate for the WNBA to uplift Black Lives Matter, which is something that the players really were behind. And that also was a political move, a lot of the players felt, because anyone who's been an owner as long or part of the WNBA as long as Kelly Loeffler should know that the WNBA have always uplifted that message. And for her to conveniently say that in this season and no others is very interesting. And the WNBA players didn't want to be used as political pawns, as some of them had said publicly.
And so they are actively supporting her Democratic opponent, who I believe is a preacher at Martin Luther King's famous church there in Atlanta. I want to thank you both so much for joining us today.
Happy to do it.
Thank you for having me.
Erica Ayala, freelance sports writer. She covers women's sports, and she's the host of the podcast Sports Talk with Erica Ayala. And Sopan Deb is a basketball and culture writer for The New York Times. Coming up, coronavirus cases are dropping here in California. How that happened, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. And now a bit of good news. COVID numbers for L.A. County are declining. L.A. meets many of the state's benchmarks now. But Public Health Director Barbara Ferrer says L.A. is still not considering allowing elementary schools to reopen.
Given the need to review the implications of the new state guidance on school reopening plans, at this point, we're not ready to open up our waiver process.
Meanwhile, Governor Gavin Newsom announced a partnership with a Massachusetts-based diagnostics company to more than double the state's testing capacity. We're going to talk about all this now with two people, Dr. George Rutherford, professor of epidemiology at UC San Francisco. Welcome back.
Hi, thanks.
And Colleen Shelby, reporter at the LA Times. Hi, Colleen.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. Let's begin with the numbers. What do they look like now in Los Angeles?
So Los Angeles's numbers have continued to decline in case counts and hospitalizations. We finally dropped below 200 cases per 100,000 residents. We're now on average about 191 cases over a 14-day period. So that's been the biggest piece of progress. Once we drop below 100, we will be able to come off the watch list if that remains for about 3 days.
And what about the positivity rate? What does that look like?
Positivity rate has also dropped. Over the past week, we're now below 8%. And again, that's the safety threshold on the state's watch list. We've dipped between 5 and 6 as of lately. That's pretty in keeping with the statewide positivity rate as well.
That is good news compared to what it looked like a month ago. So what is the reason for this drop?
I mean, I think from a statewide reason, that people are wearing masks, people are socially distancing, and people are doing what we're asking of them. You've seen the turnaround in a number of counties. San Diego, Orange, Santa Cruz have all gotten off the watch list. A lot of it is because the epidemic has also moved from the big urban areas much more into the Central Valley. I'll let Colleen talk about Los Angeles. But up here in Northern California, you see people wearing masks all the time.
Right. It seems like there are more people wearing masks here, too. Right, Colleen?
That's true. And we saw big spikes after the holiday weekends. So the big spike in June occurred after Memorial Day weekend, after there was, the shutdowns. And then again over the 4th of July. So a lot of the increases in numbers we saw were connected to these specific events and activity. And since we haven't had something like that in a while, we're also seeing a decline because there hasn't been that same sort of movement that we saw earlier in the summer.
But Labor Day is right around the corner.
It is indeed. Right. And that's cause for concern. Yep.
And Dr. Ferrer said yesterday during her briefing that, Labor Day, while they are thinking about it and while it is a concern in terms of, transmission rates, it does not seem like there is any concrete decisions right now at this point in terms of eliminating what people can do.
Let's talk about testing. And Dr. Rutherford, there's some controversy involving the CDC with Dr. Robert Redfield changing the recommendation earlier this week, basically saying asymptomatic people exposed to the virus don't necessarily need to get tested. He did walk that back today a little bit, saying testing may be considered. What does this back and forth message send to people, to the public?
I think it confuses them. I mean, from the people I deal with, they were shocked. It's like the scene in Casablanca. I'm shocked to see that the political influence occurs here. But it's as I said yesterday, it's public health malpractice to think that way. If you look at when people transmit and the maximum period of transmission, when you have 40% of the people who are asymptomatic all the time, and the other 60% of the 3 days they're most infectious, one of those days they're pre-symptomatic, that means that 60% of the transmissions occur from people who are asymptomatic to people, to other people. So it's just crazy. It's crazy. You know, if you want to stop, if you want to slow testing down, but that's not the way to do it. It just completely messes up contact tracing, and it's going to lead to ongoing, you know, if people pay attention to it, which nobody really needs to because it is a recommendation. But it will lead to increased transmission, and it'll eventually lead to deaths. And it's just, you know, there's no reason for it whatsoever. I think most people thought it was just pure politics about trying to keep numbers down.
Do you think Dr. Redfield should resign?
I said so yesterday. That's not going to happen. I think it's very problematic that that sort of political. And I'd have to say that I think it's probably political in nature. If it were about supplies and pipelines and things like that, they would have said so. And the way that it came out, it was just sort of slinked out and not made a big deal of. Would suggest to me that it was they thought they could slide it by.
Well, I guess the other fear that this raises is, will people be able to trust the CDC when a vaccine comes along, when the CDC says it's safe, if it's making these contradictory statements now about testing?
Yeah, well, FDA is actually the one that says it's safe, which is the good news. I'm concerned. I think that both Dr. Fauci and Dr. Collins, the director of NIH, have been very clear on safety as a paramount concern. And I think that we have to defer to their expertise and their experience and their goodwill to make this happen in the best way possible, where we have vaccines that are both highly effective and are safe.
However, we did have a problem with the FDA and its recommendation regarding blood plasma treatment. Many scientists came out and said that they had their facts wrong. So, again, how do you trust federal health officials, be it from the FDA or the CDC, when it comes to a vaccine, if they're getting these numbers now wrong or the advice wrong?
Well, I think that the convalescent plasma issue was, I think Dr. Hahn walked that back reasonably successfully. But you got to, you know, I understand that everybody's going to take this stuff with a grain of salt. But this is from the career people at CDC and the career people at FDA, I think it's going to be the best advice we're going to get, and they're going to try and do the best things for the country. Now, obviously, there could be political pressure brought to bear to move things out more expeditiously or incautiously. And I think that you're going to have to look to the states to be, to be the protector of public health. And unfortunately, that's what it's going to come down to.
Well, Colleen, speaking of that, Governor Newsom, as I mentioned earlier, has announced this new testing deal. But it looks like the new testing capacity won't be up and running until November. Why so late?
That's right. It says it will take about 8 to 10 weeks for the plan to come together. And then at that point, it would roll out. It would be about 24 hours to 48 hours until people saw test results. But it is a bit of time. This would be in addition to the testing that's already going on. So it wouldn't completely affect things. But yeah, it would be nice to have expanded testing sooner than later. But there is a process in place that takes time.
And so what is the hope with this new contract? And it is a very expensive contract. I believe it's over $1 billion, right? $1.5 billion or so. So what is the hope there?
I think the hope is expanding testing by 150,000 tests per day throughout the state is what the plan is. They're hoping to speed up the process in which people get their test results. I mean, if you recall earlier in the summer, there were these mass delays for people getting their results back. And a result after, you know, a week can prove to be pointless if you've been infected that entire time. So I think the process gearing up towards the holiday season really is, you know, hopefully will help people get information back more quickly during a pretty crucial time, I think.
LA Times reporter Colleen Shelby and Dr. George Rutherford, epidemiologist at UCSF. Thank you both very much.
Our pleasure. Thank you very much.
For having us.
Coming up, LA architect Frank Gehry has designed the new Eisenhower Memorial set to open next month in Washington. His initial design was rejected.
By night, apparently, this screen becomes marvelous because it's lit up and the light sort of beams through it. It's probably almost cinematic.
Francis Anderton on why it took 20 years to get this memorial built, next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. We're having a nationwide debate about monuments, who gets to be memorialized and how. And against that backdrop, a new memorial is set to be unveiled next month in Washington, honoring President Dwight D. Eisenhower. The memorial took 2 decades to be built. The final version was designed by Frank Gehry, who had to make some big changes to his original modern concept after some loud objections. Frances Anderton is KCRW's resident design and architecture expert, and she recently talked with Frank Gehry about the Eisenhower Memorial, and she's here now. Hi.
Hello, Madeline.
Well, this has been a long, long journey for Frank Gehry. Congress authorized this back in 1999 when Bill Clinton was president. So what has happened between then and now?
Oh, so much. And I remember seeing Frank in the ongoing process, and at times it got exceedingly stressful because of the pushback. So there was a design competition for this project. He won it in 2010. And he presented a concept then for a memorial which is quite different from what one might typically expect. He took what was a 4-acre site. It was then used as a parking area. It was opposite the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum. It was surrounded on the 3 other sides by rather dreary bureaucratic buildings. He suggested turn this into an urban park, put in it modestly scaled sculptures, put on pedestals, and on one of those sculptures, one of the central sculptures, would be Dwight D. Eisenhower, in fact depicted as a humble boy. On 3 sides, he proposed a really seemingly radical concept, which would be large woven metal screens depicting moments from Eisenhower's life. In particular, Ike's own home in Abilene, Kansas. He referred to himself many times as just a boy from Abilene. So I asked Frank when I spoke with him last week about why he chose this approach, which now seems very timely, given the objections to the sort of the white guy on the horse type of statue that there has been a bit of a backlash against recently. This is what he told me.
We knew Eisenhower was not that guy. He, in fact, left word with his family, for God's sakes, don't put me on a horse.
Don't put me on a horse. That's really funny. So apparently there was this huge outcry, right, that because he wasn't on a horse, it didn't seem sufficiently reverential. Was that the argument?
That was part of the argument. Absolutely. There were objections as to how Eisenhower himself was depicted. And then there was a huge reaction against this concept of these woven metal screens, which, by the way, Frank is referring to as tapestries. And the pushback came from various commissions, as well as members of Eisenhower's own family. And it very much took the form of what was Frank doing, offering this seemingly kind of abstract, modern concept for a memorial which broke from the kind of neoclassical tradition. Frank himself would say tapestries, albeit his modern variant, fit absolutely into the sort of neoclassical language. He also was going to hold up his tapestries on large columns, albeit not Corinthian columns with fancy curlicues, but still columns. So he would say, look carefully and you'll actually see a kind of neoclassical language. But to the critics, of which there were very loud voices, they only saw something radically disrespectful of Dwight D. Eisenhower.
Hmm. It does seem that whenever there's a memorial proposed, there seems to be a lot of pushback over whether it's sufficiently respectful of the subject and whether whose vision it's really portraying. So I guess Gehry decided to change the design. What kinds of changes did he make?
Yeah, and by the way, you're absolutely right, Madeline. You're probably thinking of Meyer Lin's controversial design for the Vietnam War Memorial that is now a celebrated memorial in Washington, D.C., but very much broke with tradition. So what Gary did was, well, one, Eisenhower, the boy from Abilene, that sculpture was moved to a different corner of the site. The sculptures themselves became more of the type that his critics wanted. He also removed two of these large screens. There was going to be, as I say, three. So he ended up with just one of them. And he changed the design that was on this tapestry itself. No longer the boy from Abilene. It became a celebration of the momentous event in Dwight D. Eisenhower's career, which was the D-Day invasion on the Normandy coast of France that took place on June 6th, 1944. And what Gary did was he made a sketch of the cliffs where the soldiers bravely engaged with that invasion.
The real drawing is small. I looked at the cliffs. I looked at the environment. I did a simple drawing of it. And for the kind of transparency we needed for the tapestry, it kind of works. It tells you where you are, tells you what happened, where it started, and the story's there.
So this is a huge steel, as he calls it, as Gary calls it, tapestry, which is at the backside of this memorial, right? So when you're a visitor, what does it look like?
Well, you will stand essentially with your back to the mall, and you will be in a grassy area. You will be surrounded by vegetation, plants, trees. This is meant to be a landscape experience as well. And you will be looking towards the education building. And what you will see is to your left and right, you will see pedestals, the kind of blocky, almost sculptural forms that Gary is known for. And on those will be sculptures. Eisenhower with civilian and military leaders and people and soldiers. And then between those soldiers, you will look towards the screen. The screen essentially frames the entire experience. And that screen is going to be quite extraordinary because it's massive, 300 by 600 feet, but it's also intended to be light, kind of diaphanous. It filters light through it. You can see through it. I just want to give credit, by the way, to the fabricator of the woven mesh design. It was Thomas Osinski. He's a designer who's worked a lot with Frank. It was he that figured out how to make it. So that's what you'll see. Now, I should say that by day, Frank's sketch projected up at this enormous scale feels sketchy. You know, mm-hmm. Frank has a way of drawing that's almost scribbles. It's very organic and it's very intuitive. By night, apparently, this screen becomes marvelous because it's lit up and the light sort of beams through it. It's probably almost cinematic. And so it becomes an experience of light and shadow or light and dark.
Interesting. It'll be unveiled September 17th. And will Gary be there?
Unfortunately, Gary won't be there. Gary is an extremely active 91-year-old, but he did say that he's slightly more at risk of COVID. So he is sheltering in place at his home in Santa Monica. This has meant that he wasn't able to actually go to DC and, you know, monitor the finishing touches, but he's been doing that online. And he's been staying fit at home, he says, by swimming half a mile a day.
Wow. I don't swim half a mile a day.
He's very determined. I think the fact that he swims half a mile a day sort of tells you all you need to know about Frank Gehry. I mean, this memorial became such a challenge at times. They were so vicious, some of the criticisms. Gehry soldiers on.
Well, one day we'll all be able to see it in person once we decide to get on an airplane and brave crowds again. Frances Anderton, host of KCRW's DNA podcast, and we've been talking about the new Frank Gehry designed Eisenhower Monument in Washington, expected to be unveiled September 17th. Frances, thank you.
You're so welcome, Madeline.
Coming up, Mr. Soul, a 70s era TV show that had this radical idea, show the complexity of Black culture. A new documentary on the gay Black creator of it, Ellis Hazlip, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, once upon a time in America, there was a TV talk show that was unapologetically Black. James Baldwin was a guest. So was poet Amiri Baraka, Louis Farrakhan. Musicians like Earth, Wind, and Fire and Patti LaBelle performed. It was 1968. There were platform shoes and big afros and a perspective that existed nowhere else on television. The show was made by Black people for Black people. It was called Soul! Exclamation point. And it was hosted by a mild-mannered man named Ellis Hazlip. His story and the story of the show is now being told by his niece, Melissa Hazlip, in her new documentary, Mr. Soul. And she joins me now. Welcome.
Hi, Madeline. Great to be here. Thank you so much for having us.
Well, great to have you, along with Emmy Award-winning actor Blair Underwood, who is the executive producer and narrator of the film. Hi, Blair.
Hi, Madeline. Thank you for having me and us. Glad to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. All right. So, Melissa, how did Ellis come up with the idea for this show in the first place?
Well, he really wanted to do something that was unique for New York and unique for New Yorkers. You know, the late 1960s were both tumultuous and also progressive, and it was a difficult time to be a Black American for anyone to be existing at that time. But I think the idea was that to give voice to the underserved, to give voice to poets and activists and people of the African diaspora, and to give us a platform. And some folks thought it would be a good idea to make the Black Tonight Show, but I think the idea really was to change the public perception of Black America and really to create a space for Black artists and innovators. So the idea was to really mirror Black culture in a way that it hadn't been seen before, because the airwaves really weren't integrated at the time.
Right. So at the time, so late 60s, early 70s, the show was on the air for what, about 5 years?
Yeah.
68 to 73? About?
Yes.
So you, at that time, you didn't see a lot of Black faces on TV unless they were, you know, criminals, really, right?
Absolutely. And there was, you know, the media had been weaponized, you know, against African Americans. And of course, that was an extension of Jim Crow. And that was an extension of, you know, the issues post-civil rights and the civil rights movement. So it was a way to sort of reimagine ourselves in this American landscape, and this idea that there could be more progressive, more expansive images and more opportunities for African American culture to be experienced.
And Blair, well, both of you were too young to have actually watched the show when it was on the air, but Blair, how did you get
born
interested
yet?
In this?
I wasn't born yet. I'm sorry. I know Melissa wasn't either.
Well, okay. You say so.
Surely I do.
Yes. But you were too young to watch it, right? I mean, you were probably watching Sesame Street instead.
Yeah.
So what got you interested in this?
Well, I would tell you that I was born in 64. So I was, not only was I too young, but I did not know about this show at the time. You know, it started off in New York and then became a national show. This really is, and I always preface my comments, because I want to give Melissa credit, because she wrote, directed, produced it. It's in her family history. It's in her DNA. So when she approached me to be the narrator, the voice of Ellis Hazlip, I was blown away by what she had compiled, just the images. And there was clips from the show, and she had this beautiful trailer for the movie. And, you know, as a narrator, you're like the last thing involved. You kind of lay the voice over in the connective tissue of the story. But I was blown away that I did not know of this show. I was not aware, because anybody who was anybody, you mentioned at the very top some of the artists that were part of the show that came through there, and they were actors, politicians, musicians. It was an amazing thing. So I was not aware of it as much as I should have, and was very much excited about being a part of telling the story.
So this comes out of the civil rights movement, and a civil rights movement that really was marked at the end with lots of periods of violence, tragedy, assassinations. I want to play a clip of activist Stokely Carmichael. And this is what he said on the show. And I want to play this because this is something that you wouldn't hear on, well, you wouldn't hear anywhere really on TV, either then or now.
Your history don't begin 400 years. Your history begins millions and millions and millions and millions of years ago, while the white boy was in the caves. Your fathers were building pyramids. The Eiffel Tower is falling. The pyramids are standing strong. You built them, brother.
So, Melissa, you said that this was Ellis's vision to present the totality of Black culture and also to present it to a larger audience? Or was it mainly to say, was it mainly about presenting Black culture to a Black audience?
I think that really was his raison d'etre. I think he really felt it was important to say, we have a renaissance happening here. We are existing under this gaze that has never really appreciated the fullness and the richness. And that's what made the show so highly controversial and almost unorthodox for its time, you know, due to both its sort of political content about race, and not to mention the format. And also what it did single-handedly was provide an insight into the interiority of Black people. It was just to say, this is what we do, and this is how we get down. And if you enjoy that, you can be entertained by it. But we're not here to entertain you. The priority is to share the richness of the Black experience. Here you had him showing people with, you know, historical weight and significance, like James Baldwin and Patti LaBelle.
And now, the very first musical performance of our show, Sarah Dash, Nona Hendricks, Patricia Hope, also known as Patti LaBelle and the Bluebells.
So you don't often see that. That's certainly not the model we knew for late night television.
Right. And so you'd have Stevie Wonder there, Earth, Wind & Fire, like musicians who went on to become huge, you know, worldwide global musicians appearing on this public television show.
I love your choice of the word global, because I feel that Ellis was a global citizen, and he was the first person to produce a version of James Baldwin's play, The Amen Corner, the international tour. And that was as early as 1965. And he was working with Marlene Dietrich. So he had this vision of acceptance and a freedom that he felt, much like James Baldwin felt as an expat in, you know, St. Paul de Vence.
Like James Baldwin, he was gay and openly gay. And there's a pretty remarkable scene in your movie of him interviewing Louis Farrakhan, who was avowedly anti-gay, and they actually talk about it.
And does the fact that a man is a homosexual have anything to do that would negate his coming into the nation and being dealt with by the Nation of Islam?
The Honorable Elijah Muhammad has been raised up by Allah not to condemn our people, but to reclaim the fallen Black man of America.
That was really radical. And what we decided to do was focus on Ellis's bravery in asking that question, rather than vilify the minister, because he has many, there are so many issues that surround him, including anti-Semitism and others too long to mention. But as we were looking at that episode, what was most important was to focus on Ellis's bravery in confronting him and asking that question. And you saw two men who were equally respectful of each other, even though they were diametrically opposed.
Blair, when you were voicing the words of Ellis and providing the narration, how did you want to kind of convey who he was on the screen with your voice?
Well, you know, the first thing is you don't want to try to necessarily imitate someone. But he did have a very specific cadence and, I guess, zone in which he spoke. And I wanted to play with that. But from a more directorial standpoint, you know, Melissa had mentioned that she wanted to really get inside of his head. So a lot of what he said were taken from interviews that he had given, as I understand it. So it's a lot of it was in his own words, if not all of it in his own words. but it's more of a stream of consciousness. It's him talking and hearing his voice in that. So therefore, I did not want it to, and our director, Melissa, did not want to have it sound as if it's my voice speaking objectively, but more from an internal standpoint.
How did it change your sense of Black performers on TV, in movies? I mean, you are a Black actor, and I'm wondering if going through this project has shifted the way you understand your own work.
You know, I would tell you, Melissa used the word a couple of times just now, courageous. I'm struck by that now more than ever. And in this moment today, I'm not sure when this will air, but I will say on this day, August 26th, if I may, you know, the NBA just decided not to play their three playoff games today. For athletes to stand up and take that stand with LeBron James kind of taking the lead and all of that, that's courage. That's bravery. And I was just talking to some artistic friends in New York from the Broadway community, and they're saying, we have to make sure we take our stand. You know, we speak up for ourselves, and there is art and there's power in that. But and there are politics. There is the body politic, and oftentimes art fuses all of that together. But what Ellis Hazlett did then, as a courageous man, not just because of his artistry that he was pushing forward, wherever it came from, out of a need to leave New York and go overseas, wherever else, but also whether or not it's because he was a gay man, whatever it took, he was courageous. And I think as an artist, I'm inspired by that. Then I'm inspired by what I see athletes doing today. I'm inspired by this moment in history. You know, earlier today, Melissa and I were talking about history and this show sold from an historical perspective, but we are living history today. The world, this country is convulsing in a way, giving birth to a whole new understanding of race relations, of our own humanity, of our own individual representation of who we are. It's an amazing and exciting time.
Yeah. So it was a very short-lived show, 5 years. It ended in 1973, and that's because it couldn't get any more funding. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting didn't want to fund it anymore.
Part of it was funding, and I think part of it was the climate, and some of it may have been the administration. As we know, Nixon was not a fan of public media, and in very similar fashion to our current administration, a Nixon administration really pushed back on liberal expression in the media. And so here you have a very liberal expression of Black power television, enlightenment, Black love, Black art, Black sister and brotherhood, Black politics and controversy. And that could be perceived as very threatening. And there's one line that Ellis says, and that Blair so beautifully and poignantly expresses with his voiceover, which is,
sometimes it's necessary in the evolution of things to disappear.
Mm.
I was felt so profoundly about that statement, and we used it in the film at a critical moment when Ellis was both losing a family member and losing his show. So he was really suffering professionally and personally.
Do you think that there could be a show like that again today? Is there a need for a show like that again today? Or is it really a creature of that moment in time?
You know, Madeline, you know, the closest thing we had to the Soul show in recent memory was the Arsenio Hall show. And it's interesting to note that Arsenio Hall was premiered on the Soul show at, I think it was 16 years old. How old was he, Melissa? Very
15.
Young boy, 15, as a magician. But I think that's the closest we've had, really, or seen to the Soul show. I think there's definitely a need for it and a place for it in our culture right now.
I mean, I see the Arsenio Hall show as more in the tradition of a Johnny Carson show, you know, Tonight Show, rather than, and like Ellis's show more of a in the tradition of a Dick Cavett type show. Kind of more about intellectual issues. Melissa, what were you going to say?
One of the reasons it's so exciting to bring this film out right now is because we are going through such a difficult time, and the nation is on this eve of a great racial reckoning. And I like to think that even in this space and this difficulty, we have to recognize what Ellis recognized, which is Black joy is revolutionary. And being able to to celebrate that the way Soul did.
I want to thank you both so much for coming on this show today. I appreciate that.
Oh, it's great to chat with you.
Yeah, thank you, Madeline. Appreciate you.
My pleasure.
Yeah.
Melissa Hazelip, writer, director, and producer, Blair Underwood, narrator and executive producer of Mr. Soul. And it opens this Friday virtually at the Lemley in Los Angeles. Very superstitious. And that's it for us. But before we go, KCRW has teamed up with stations across the state today in celebration of the first California Public Radio Day. That's right. It's an official day to show your love for nonprofit local radio. So naturally, we have a challenge grant in place. Today, your gift will be doubled up to $10,000 thanks to our KCRW champion, Julie Burton. You can give at kcrw.com/give. kcrw.com/give. Thank you for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.